Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. I hope you had a chance to go out this morning to the VA Medical Center in Fresno for the unveiling of that new prisoner of war monument that we talked about last week. This week, we're going to talk to a bombardier, navigator, radar expert, 3-in-1, and probably some more talents to boot that Wayne Thompson will share with us today. Wayne is 86 years old. He had 30 missions in B-17s over the skies of Europe during World War II. And if you've ever driven down the 99 past the Tulare area and you see Mefford Field with a big B-17 out front, you see that marking on the tail, the big K. Well, Wayne is going to tell us what that K stands for, because that was part of his group, the 379th Bomb Group, flying out of England during World War II. Wayne, welcome to the program, and let's start a little bit earlier than that. You're growing up in Sharon, Pennsylvania, right?
That's right.
A little colder than the Central Valley.
Yes. Yeah, I can remember where... We lived in an old home, second floor, had no heat. So used to get up and run down the first floor to get dressed.
I wouldn't blame you, as long as you don't slip on the icy stairs, right?
Right.
Well, and I guess that's where you were on December 7th, 1941, probably shivering a little bit.
Well, I was actually at Ohio State.
Oh, that's right. You were in school.
At Columbus, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget... exactly where I was, Paul, but I know a couple of my buddies were sitting there, and when it came on, I guess it was on the radio because there was no TV in those days.
Nope.
And we looked at each other and said, uh-oh, something's going to happen now. And we discussed it a little bit, and we said, I don't want to be a grunt. Not that I have anything against the grunts, but I said, I want to get into the Air Force. And that's what I did, and that was December of 41, so I kept going to school in 42.
And you were an engineering major there at Ohio State?
Yes. And then in February of 43, I was inducted into the Air Force.
Now, I'm sure that when you were growing up and you went off to school at Ohio State to be an engineer, you didn't have any kind of military ideas in mind. How big of an adjustment was it for you to go from thinking, oh, I'm pursuing a career in engineering, to I've got to go do something for my country?
Well, it wasn't too much, Paul, because I guess you'd have to have been there to feel it, but there was a tension and an atmosphere of what can we do for our country? And even though we didn't want to be taken out of college, I felt that it was a pretty big thing to be able to jump into the Air Force and be a potential pilot in the Air Force. So.
And that's the one, and people who listen to this show regularly are probably sick of hearing me say this, but every time I interview someone who was in the Air Corps, I ask that question, because it seems like no matter if you ended up as a bombardier or a gunner or a navigator, you chose the Air Corps because you wanted to be a pilot, right?
Yes, yes. And you may want to talk to about it later, Paul, but later on in my cadet training, it was discovered I was colorblind. So they immediately ran me out of being a pilot, and I got back in on a waiver to be a bombardier. So that's how I happened to be a bombardier. I was really disappointed that I wasn't going to. By that time, I had 10 hours of flying in a Piper Cub.
And once you get that taste of it, you don't want to let it go, right?
Yeah, I was hot to trot.
And by the time this program's over, we're going to hear all kinds of stories from Wayne about those 30 missions in the skies over Europe, including how he earned a Distinguished Flying Cross with the 379th Bomb Group. But let's talk about this training. Now, they ship you off, and here you are from the Northeast, a Pennsylvania boy, and you get to go to Miami Beach for
right.
training. This is supposed to be a job and work and the Army Air Corps. It sounds like a vacation.
I'll start you off on my first day, Paul. I reported at Fort Thomas, Kentucky, which is right across from Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
So I hear him standing in this railroad station, just got off of the train, and there was nobody there. And here I am at, 18? looking around, not knowing what's going to happen. But pretty soon an Army car came up, picked me up. But my first day of duty was to be on KP on a troop train going towards Miami Beach, Florida.
Now that is not a vacation.
No, we made a lot of jokes about, you know, being tough duty in Miami Beach because there were other places that weren't very good. In fact, I had KP duty down there. I think it was about 1,000 cadets.
That's a lot of KP.
That's a lot of KP.
And I think most of our listeners know what KP is, but you want to clue them in if they don't?
Well, it was supposedly called for kitchen police or kitchen something duty, but it basically was doing all the stuff to help the cooks, and it was scrubbing pots and pans or taking out garbage or helping to serve. That was KP duty.
So Wayne was on kitchen patrol for a while, and then he got to train in a Piper Cub. And somewhere in the middle of all this, there's a woman in the picture, too.
Yeah, as I was telling Paul, my wife and I were born in the same hospital a day apart, but we never met each other until we were out of high school. And even when I was down at Ohio State, we kept in contact. And as by the time I got into bombardier, we were pretty serious. So I don't know where you want to go with this, Paul. But.
Well, we've got so many different directions, and I don't want to get over the flying time that you had. What was that? Was that a big rush for you to be up in the air and controlling an airplane?
Yes. Can you imagine? I did not even have a car when I was in high school. I was lucky to drive my dad's car on a date. And so you can't say that I was used to having something going fast or whatever. But the first time I was up, I said, man, this is something. This is something. And we were not allowed to solo, but they did give us 10 hours of flying. And we got to do everything, including doing spins, which is, that's quite an experience. In fact, nowadays, they don't even require you to spin to get your license.
So you were hooked, just
yeah,
like that.
I was hooked.
And I suppose then it must have been a real tough blow to deal with when they told you, sorry, you're colorblind, you're not a pilot for us anymore.
My morale was down on the floor. And I scooted around and found out that it was possible to get a waiver. And I did that, and I got accepted. And so immediately I was put back into what was called the cadet training program. The only difference was I was trained as a bombardier, not as a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we flew an AT-11s, which was a twin-engine plane for bombing and navigation, but it was not a hot pursuit.
No, and a B-17 wasn't either. This was going to be a big beast you'd end up on. But as some of our listeners know, when you're on a bombing run in a B-17, there's one person that's in control of that aircraft.
That's right.
And that was?
That was me. In fact, as standard bombardier, every plane had a bombardier in the nose. But because I was a radar bombardier navigator, I flew lead, and I was actually directing 12 planes, or in some cases, 24 planes or 36 planes over a target.
No pressure.
No pressure.
Well, I know we're bouncing here and there and everywhere with this story so far, and that's my fault for leading you in different directions, but I don't want to get past the story of you getting married before you went over, because a lot of guys said, you know what, I don't know if I'm coming back, so just wait. If I come back, we'll get married then. And some other guys said, hey, I don't want some other guy to get this great girl while I'm overseas, and you were, I guess, in the latter mindset.
Yeah, I just before we got married, I talked to my wife over the phone, and I said, you know, should we really do this? You don't know what's going to happen. She said, that's why I want it.
And I know that that's still an emotional thing for you. And Wayne just lost his wife within the past year, and misses her dearly. And he's got so many memories to hold on to. And she gave you something to hold on to as you went overseas. And, well, first of all, we should tell people when you got married, too, because that's a story in its own right.
Yeah. As you can know, we our training was not 5 days a week. It was 7 days a week. So the only day that I could get off to get married was Christmas Eve. Actually, yeah, that was the only day off. So we got married on Christmas Eve, and we had some cadets in the church. And I had my best man was one of my cadet buddies. But I had to report back to Dewey the next day. So there was no honeymoon.
And this was you were at that time stationed in Carlsbad, New Mexico. Right.
And we'd never, in fact, you know, we had heard that there was Carlsbad Caverns, but we never saw them.
You were a little higher than that.
We were a little higher.
Up in the air. But so you get married on Christmas Eve of 1943.
Right.
And you say there was no honeymoon, but you did have a turn of good fortune for the next month after that.
Yes. On graduation, everybody was wondering, well, how soon are we going to go overseas? And then I got a notice that I was eligible to volunteer. Eligible to volunteer.
Funny how that works.
For celestial navigation in conjunction with the bombardiering. So me and about 20 other guys, we volunteered for it. And we reported to San Marcos, Texas. And when we got there, the CO came out to greet us and he says, why are you guys here? And we said, well, we came here for celestial navigation. And he says, I don't have any orders for you guys. So for 30 days, we would report every day to the CO for orders. And for 30 days, there were no orders, so we had a honeymoon.
There you go. You got your honeymoon after all.
We had a honeymoon.
And we're going to take our first break here, but when we come back, we'll find out what those orders were when Wayne moved on from there. We'll hear about his 30 missions over the skies of Europe during World War II with the 379th Bomb Group and how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. Wayne Thompson is our guest today. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on News Talk 580 KMJ. We've been listening to Wayne Thompson share some of his early memories from his time in the U.S. Army Air Corps. You heard about how he got married on Christmas Eve of 43 and how he got an unexpected month-long honeymoon when there weren't any orders for him every day when he checked in. The orders would come, though. They'd send him up to Casper, Wyoming, where he trained on a B-24 crew and was ready to head overseas when they threw him another curveball. Wayne, what was that curveball? And I imagine you're ready to go get some action, right? Yeah. It's been a while.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that I was being pulled off of my crew. But once we got on a troop train and was told we were going to Boca Raton, Florida, they opened the orders and said, well, you're going to radar navigation school.
Now, had you ever heard the word radar before?
No.
I didn't think so.
Did not, no. In fact, I thought I was a pretty proud accurate bombardier on a Norden bomb site, but
which you probably thought was pretty high tech. Yes. And sophisticated and yeah. Top of the line.
In fact, at 10,000 feet, I had a circle of error of 100 feet, which is pretty good.
And that's an acquired skill, isn't it? I mean, it's not like you ever have any practice looking down at the planet when you're growing up in Pennsylvania.
No, you had to be coordinated.
So you had just gotten used to that and really gotten the handle of the Norden bomb site, and they say, you're not using that. You're going to try something else. But there was a reward. They sent you to Boca Raton, Florida.
Yeah, this was a millionaire's resort. And we literally had tough duty with swimming pools, tennis courts, golf courses. The ocean was right next to us. But we didn't have much time to enjoy it because we flew almost every day on B-17s.
And you had been with B-24s. Was it an adjustment to you to get used to a different plane?
Not too bad. In fact, pretty soon we decided we were B-17 lovers.
Well, you know, it's funny, and you hear this from guys who flew P-47s versus P-51s, and you definitely hear it with B-17s versus B-24s. Both guys think they had the best plane. You spent some time in both of them.
Yes.
What do you think?
I was impressed that a 17, I thought, took more damage and still got back than a 24.
Well, you're living proof, aren't you?
Yes.
So you're flying B-17s over the Florida area, and how long was it until they said, okay, time to head across the pond?
Well, I'm going to guess, Paul, that it was roughly September of 44. Okay, this is, by the way, you know, this is after D-Day.
Right.
So, you know, we were wondering, were we going to get over there to do something? So it was about September when we got to Langley Field and picked up the 17. And shortly thereafter, we flew the 17 by way of Iceland, Greenland, into Wales, England. Turned the 17 over, and then I went to a special radar school there for about a month. Then I was assigned to the 379th.
And so finally, in December, in fact, December 11th of 1944, as your yep. log kept on a piece of a V-mail envelope there, indicates, December 11th, 44, the target was Mannheim, and you finally had your first bombing mission. What do you remember about that?
I remember that anti-aircraft fire really is anti-aircraft fire. And an old-timer told me over there, he said, as long as you can see the black clouds, you're okay. But when you start hearing it, then you know it's getting close.
And when you feel it, it's the worst, huh?
Right.
So did you feel any flak that day?
No. I really can't tell you, Paul, what made my luck different, but I really never had close hits from flak. We had a lot of bad weather, and a couple of times I thought we were going to have collisions because of bad weather, but it's just one of those things.
Well, and you bore a heavy responsibility for that as the navigator bombardier on the yes. lead aircraft.
Yes.
And I don't want to miss one important thing here, too. And we had a bombardier on this program a while back who had a silver dollar that his wife gave him that he carried with him on every bombing mission. Your wife gave you something else that you wore every time you went up in the sky.
Yeah, she gave me a special wrist bracelet with my name on it, and I wore it every mission.
And I'm sure there are plenty of times you looked over at it and thought of her, right?
Yes.
So now explain to our listeners, if you can, the significance of being the lead aircraft and why it was you, why you had to be the bombardier on that lead aircraft on all of these missions.
Okay. You might call it, Paul, a triple layer of backup. We had a regular bombardier, we had a regular navigator, but so much of Germany was overcast in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the bombardier and the navigator couldn't see, they were useless in terms of being effective.
Right.
And that's where the radar took over. So many days I actually took squadrons or two squadrons or three squadrons, sometimes a group lead. I took them in because I could see by radar where we were going.
So you're sitting in the nose of the airplane?
No, I'm sitting just back of the bomb bay.
Because you needed room for the radar equipment.
Yeah,
huh?
And the radio op was on my left and I was on the right. And radar unit was just behind me in the fuselage area.
And I don't want to overstate it, but I'm just trying to get a picture of how big of a deal this is, and I'm sure our listeners are trying to figure it out too. A lot of these missions, correct me if I'm wrong, but you've got squadron after squadron heading for the same bombing target, and they're all dependent on you in that lead plane to direct them to the target.
Yes.
Was that pressure on you?
Well, maybe part of it was being the wonders of youth. We were all scared. You got to admit that, and particularly if there's bad flak coming up and aircraft fire. But it was just a job, I think, Paul. You know, and I had the courage and the skill and the drive to make damn sure it was okay. You know, everything was going to be okay.
And you were 21 years old.
21.
That's a lot of responsibility for a 21-year-old.
Yeah, we were glad to be back at the end of the flight. You know, sometimes it was 10 hours, 11 hours, and you were on oxygen from 12,000 feet up, and we usually went in at 25,000 or 27,000. So there was no pressurized cabin. It was cold. it was miserable.
Yeah, this is December of 44, the coldest winter that Europe had ever seen.
Yes.
And you're higher up with no pressurized cabin. Brr, again. And I know you have the list of all the missions that you flew here, and we're going to hear about how you earned the DFC. But I'm curious, that first mission, you went up, you dropped the bombs, you came back down, you realized you made it in one piece. Was there any sense of relief or accomplishment or I really can do this that went along with that?
I think in retrospect, Paul, that I was, first, I was glad I got back. Mm-hmm. We landed. I was tired. And sometimes they would give you a jigger of cognac when you went into briefing. And by the time you got done with that jigger of cognac, you and plus flying for 10, 11 hours at altitude, well, it relaxed you, but
your brain didn't have the energy to think about it too much, which was probably a blessing in disguise.
I think so.
And another thing that strikes me, I've talked to so many guys who flew in bombers during World War II, and they talk about the camaraderie that they had with the crew that they flew all of these missions with. You didn't get to experience that because of your unique position. You were bouncing around different crew every mission?
Yes. I can only think of maybe one or two times where I flew with the same crew more than once. And I'm not sure whether that was true for other people, other radar guys, but it was rare to ever have more than one or two times with a crew.
Well, and so many guys tell me they felt confident and safe and secure with the crew because they had that trust with the other guys and they knew them so well, they'd been through so much together. How did you, had to trust all these pilots that you'd never flown with before.
Well, usually, Paul, they were also first-rate people. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, sometimes the lead pilot was a colonel as opposed to a first lieutenant in some of the regular air crews. So, yeah, I felt that I was flying with the best every time, so I didn't worry about that.
Well, and speaking of the best, and again, if I misstate anything, I trust you to correct me, but the 379th Bomb Group was part of the 8th Air Force.
Yes.
And I believe by this time, the gentleman in control of the 8th Air Force, the commanding officer for all of the 8th Air Force, was a pretty famous guy, wasn't it?
Yes, I think it was Jimmy Doolittle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You talk about the best. Did you ever have any interactions with him or come across him?
I only had reaction or contact, not with him personally, but when I was living in Arizona, Tucson, I went to a Jimmy Doolittle reunion.
Mm-hmm.
And as I recall, I think he had died by that time, but they had a reunion. So here comes 26 B-25s came in and landed at their field.
Mm-hmm.
And they had been rebuilt and reconditioned, but it was pretty hair-raising.
I can imagine that would take your breath away a little bit. Did that mean anything to you? And I don't want to just gravitate toward one name in 16 million Americans who were serving at that time, but to know that Jimmy Doolittle was in charge of your 8th Air Force and knowing what he had done off the Hornet and bombing Tokyo and all of that, was that a big deal to you?
Well, I think only in terms of you felt good about it. You felt that here was a guy who knew what was going on, and he had to fight to get a lot of his stuff. Plus, after I got back from overseas, I got to be an instructor on a B-25 to instruct radar bombing.
Mm-hmm.
So I was reunited in a sense with Jimmy Doolittle.
Well, you got all the toys. You flew in a B-24, a B-17, a B-25. There's probably some more we haven't heard about yet. And maybe we need to take another break and hear about it when we come back. We haven't got into the nitty-gritty of some of these missions with Wayne Thompson, but we're going to do that when Hometown Heroes continues here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Very unique guest today, Wayne Thompson. He's 86 years old. He had 30 missions over Europe during World War II. in a very unique role as a radar navigator bombardier, using equipment that a lot of guys wouldn't know what to do with, but he was specially trained for it, and part of the responsibility was that he would have to fly with the lead aircraft on 30 bombing missions over Europe during World War II. Some were hairier than others, and when you fly 30 of them, they all kind of blend in together. He still has the list and the dates, and two dates in particular that became significant for him after the fact were March 2nd and March 30th of 1945. I'm going to read for you the text of a citation for the Distinguished Flying Cross, which Wayne received, not even knowing that he received it, and we'll get that story. But here it goes. It says, Wayne B. Thompson, 1st Lieutenant, Air Corps, United States Army, for extraordinary achievement while serving as radar navigator of bombardment formations composed of B-17 aircraft on bombing missions over Germany, 2 March 1945 and 30 March 1945. Unable to bomb the primary target on 2 March 1945, Lieutenant Thompson directed the formation to a secondary objective where an instrument bomb run was initiated. Although excessive headwinds were encountered, this officer furnished computations which enabled bombs to be released with accuracy. On 30 March 1945, the outstanding proficiency exhibited by Lieutenant Thompson was instrumental in the successful bombing of a vital enemy installation in the face of adverse weather conditions. The courage, coolness, and skill displayed by Lieutenant Thompson reflect the highest credit upon himself and the armed forces of the United States. And, of course, they throw a shout-out to your home state saying you entered military service from Pennsylvania. So one of Pennsylvania's finest there. And you didn't know about this until you were already back home?
I was back home. In fact, I was going to Purdue University, and I got announcement in the mail. And they want to know if I'd come to Washington, and I said I can't. Yeah, I'm going to school.
They wanted you to go to Washington to have a general pin it on you?
Yeah. So I said, I can't do that. So they said, all right, we'll mail it to you.
Uh-huh. Funny how things work. Now let's get back to these missions. So on March 2nd of 1945, and according to your log, the target that time was Chemnitz, and this says that you couldn't bomb the primary target, and that was because of the weather?
Yeah, and in fact, Paul, in those days, at least in my experience in those days, nobody talked about jet stream. But we actually had picked up a jet stream going in to the target. And I called the chief pilot, and I said, sir, if we continue on this plan, we're going to have a ground speed of about 80 miles an hour because of the headwind. So he said, well, we can't do it. And I said, that's right. So he said, what do you want to do? I said, well, let's go to the secondary, which was a different heading.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we did, and we made a good run.
But you still, no one could see the targets. It says
that's
here,
right.
An instrument bomb run.
Yeah, I used radar. And
so when you're looking through that in that radar equipment, what are you seeing that tells you you found your target, it's time to drop the bombs? Because that's a pretty significant thing to drop these bombs. If you're not hitting your target, you're killing civilians.
Right. The radar had various settings. One, you could see the whole western coast of Europe. Then as you kept reducing your ranges down, you get down to like I think it was like a 10-mile range.
Mm-hmm.
So then you're able to focus in on the target. And radar on targets, it was perfect if there was a river next to it where you could absolutely zero in on your target. Otherwise, you had to keep shooting fixes on other towns or radar maps to make sure you're on the right one.
The river would help you because there's no...
There's no return. It was just, you would see the perfect outline of the river. In fact, over Bremen, the submarine pens, you could actually almost see the pens with radar.
And obviously that's another place that you bombed. But so this, what it credits in this citation was the computations which enabled bombs to be released with accuracy. So you don't have a little computer like they have these days. You don't have a calculator in your hand. You're scribbling out on a piece of paper, doing the math to figure out that you're going to the right spot?
Yeah. Actually, part of the plan of radar bombing was you would also set up the lead bombardier in the nose. I would call out fixes to him, and the Norden bomb sight, he would then set it up so that if he could at the last second see it, he could take over.
Mm-hmm.
But usually he never saw it. But we actually, what I was actually doing was calling out successive ranges as we were going over the target areas.
Mm-hmm.
So in that process, we set up the bomb sight so it would all be an automatic drop.
Gotcha. So that was March 2nd of 1945. And then on the 30th of March that month, the other mission that this Distinguished Flying Cross citation mentions, Bremen was your target. The U-boat pens that so many people have heard of were right along the river there, as you talked about. And in this time, it says they're giving you credit because of the adverse weather conditions that you faced. Yeah. How crazy was it?
It was pretty crazy. In fact, it was difficult for the 12 planes in a squadron, it was difficult for the 12 planes to stay together. The weather was that bad. So, you know, in fact, I think, as I recall in that mission, some squadrons or other groups, some of them aborted, went back because they just couldn't hack it. They couldn't stay with it.
Now, what made your mind, and obviously you're the radar navigator of the lead plane, but this is a discussion you're probably having with your pilot as well, I imagine.
Yes.
What made that decision to keep going and make sure you hit this target?
Well, it's probably a combination. You had to have a lead pilot and his crew that were willing to take the chance of bad weather, because there's always a chance in bad weather of mid-air collisions. So, you know, maybe part of it was luck, Paul. I don't know, but he elected to go through it, and I just kept calling out the checkpoints and guiding them in.
Did you ever fly in weather where you thought it was too much and you guys came back?
Yes. There was one instance, Paul, where the weather was so bad going over the channel, over the English Channel, the weather fronts were so high and so wide that we were turned around. And can you imagine the 8th Air Force dropping all their bombs in the channel? That's what we did.
Hate to be a fisherman out there,
no.
Huh? did that, and I've every bombardier that I've talked to, I've asked this question, and you hate to ask the question because it's such a tender thing, but was it hard to wrap your brain around the idea of dropping all these bombs, knowing the destruction that they could wreak once they impacted?
Not at the time, I didn't, Paul. In fact, I don't think most of the bombardiers thought about it. There was so much action going on between anti-aircraft fire, and although I never was on a mission where we had German pilot fighters come in, that was a sure destruction mm-hmm. if that ever happened. So there was so much going on that you were just focused on getting your job done, and you came back. Interesting enough, Paul, after the war, I sang with the Santa Clara Chorale, and we took a one-month tour of Germany and Austria and Italy, and I actually went through some towns in Germany that I had bombed.
Mm.
Now, that was mind-numbing almost. I mean, I'm seeing the destruction.
There were still signs of what had happened during the war?
Particularly in Berlin, yeah.
What did that mean to you?
Well, it meant to me, Paul, I think that, you know, that war is really hell. It's, you know, because by this time, when I was on this singing tour, Germany was our friends again.
Mm-hmm.
And so was Japan. So the only other mission that I didn't know about at the time, but later it became quite controversial, was the bombardment of Dresden. You know, I was on one of those missions, and at the time we did not know, I did not know, that it had a lot of incendiary bombs.
And it became controversial because of the civilian casualties?
Yes. But on the other hand, you know, I was on a leave for a weekend in London, and I was in the middle of an air raid. bombs dropping on London, you know.
And so, this is supposed to be leave.
Yeah.
And they had quite a few buzz bombs coming through yes. London, too.
Yes.
Well, there's so much to talk about here with Wayne Thompson, who had 30 missions as a radar navigator, bombardier, and B-17s over Europe, and very unique the role that he played on the lead aircraft and all of those missions with the 379th Bomb Group. And maybe part of the blessing of that role, Wayne, was that you probably didn't have time to get close to too many guys on these crews. So, and I know a lot of them didn't come back, but maybe it wasn't as hard for you to deal with because you didn't know guys too well. Is that fair to say?
That's fair. In fact, to show you how naive you can be, when I reported for duty at the 379th, a sergeant took me to the barracks for officers. There was nothing special about them. It was open bay barracks. But about a third of the beds were empty. And I said to the sergeant, how come there's not more guys here? And he looked at me like, well, you know, you dummy. He said, well, sir, that's because that's why you're here.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first.
That gets your attention a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Is that something you ever thought about? Did you think, you know what, maybe this mission is my last mission?
Towards the end, I got that way. I said, man, I hope, you know, hope this one's going to be another good one.
Was it because you knew you were getting close to that number where you'd be able to come home?
Yeah, I think so.
And you had a wife waiting at home?
Right.
And by this time, did you know that she was expecting?
Yes, and in fact, my number one son was born while I was over in England, and I got a telegram on March 1st, 45, saying, you're the proud father of a baby boy. So
that's a pretty big incentive to get home, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, we're going to talk about when he got home and what it was like to meet his son for the first time and how many other children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren, wouldn't be here if Wayne didn't come home. We're so glad that he did. And we'll be back with the rest of Hometown Heroes next. It's News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Once again, the time's gone by too fast. We just have a few minutes left to talk to Wayne Thompson about his 30 missions as a radar navigator bombardier with the 379th Bomb Group flying out of England. And one thing I didn't ask you about, your base. It was by a castle in England?
Yes, it was Kim Bolton Castle. In fact, our 379th was called the Kim Bolton Castle Field.
That's why there's that K on the tail, right. Like the B-17 at Medford Field in Tulare.
Right, right. And, in fact, I show Paul pictures here of the King and Queen of England visited Kim Bolton. I wasn't there at the time, but they did visit Kim Bolton.
While your bomb group was there. And
yes.
I'm going to put some of these pictures up on our website, kmjnow.com. Also now, there's a Facebook page for Hometown Heroes. Just search for Hometown Heroes on Facebook, and you can look at pictures that way and even leave messages for some of the veterans on the show if you so desire. So you're stationed at a castle. Your plane was never hit badly on any of these 30 missions, even though you're the lead aircraft with this expensive radar equipment, the high-tech stuff that was leading the whole squadron. You would think you would have been a bigger target. Sounds kind of like somebody must have been looking out for you.
I've come to that conclusion, Paul. I just, you know, at the time, I was so glad to get back each time. I didn't really dwell on it, but over the years, I've occasionally would think back on this, and I just shake my head and say, boy, I was really lucky.
And one important part of that equation, too, and a lot of guys who flew bombers earlier in the war in Europe didn't have this luxury, but you had P-51s with enough range to escort you to and from the target?
Yes. In fact, they came up with the drop tanks for fuel tanks, and which meant that P-51s could take you into Berlin all the way. And prior to that, 51s turned around and went home, and that's when the German planes came up.
Exactly. Then the ME-109s would
right.
swarm on them and take
right.
them out. So you were fortunate in that respect. And once you flew 30 missions, you got called in, and they said, Lieutenant, what did they say after that?
The captain congratulated me on my 30 missions, and he said, Lieutenant Thompson, yes, sir, how'd you like to be a captain? Well, sir, what's that mean? What do I have to do? And he shoved a piece of paper at me and said, well, you can sign this piece of paper. I said, well, what am I signing, sir? Well, you sign permission for another tour, and I'll give you your captain bars right now. And I said, thank you, sir, but no thanks.
So it was a choice between coming home to a wife and a son you've never met or flying more missions in Europe. Tough call. So when did you get home, and what did that feel like?
It was great. My wife met me in Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh was about 60 miles from Sharon, Pennsylvania. And I came in by, I believe, train into Pittsburgh, and it was a great, what a meeting.
And you had you even seen a picture of your baby boy?
No, had not.
You had the telegram. You knew he was born on March 1st.
Yeah.
What was that like to see a child for the first time?
It was just overwhelming, Paul. It just, you know, the emotions at that time, probably, I can't remember exactly, but I know how lucky I was to get home and see my son and my wife.
And you would have three more children.
Yes.
And since then, you've been blessed with five grandchildren
and
one great-grandchild.
Great job.
So that's right there. That's nine people that wouldn't be here if you didn't make it home in one piece.
Right. And, you know, I didn't maybe got time for this, Paul. When I was at Langley Field getting ready to leave, to go overseas, I met my wife at the airfield, and we said goodbye. And I said, I must be really dumb. Here you are, you're pregnant. I'm going overseas. I don't know where I'm coming back.
I know those emotions are still very strong, and you take all the time you need to
Anyhow,
get through it.
You know what? When I left her, I said, man, you know, I'm not so sure you're so smart doing all this. But it worked out.
Something tells me she was saying a few prayers for you while you were over there.
Yeah, yes, she was.
And you got a few letters from her, too.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and I know you miss her very much. She just passed away in October, so it hasn't been that long. And Wayne, I know that that all your family is certainly thankful for what you did during the war. And on behalf of our audience, I want to thank you for serving and for being willing to share with us about it. And there's one more thing you did when you came back that's kind of an interesting twist to all this. We talked about how you wanted to be a pilot, but when they found out you were colorblind and said no more, you became a pilot after all.
Yeah. Real quickly, Paul, I found out I could get my private pilot's license. And I said, well, what about being colorblind? They said, oh, that's not a problem. I said, what we'll do, we'll take you out onto the tarmac, and the tire will shoot colored light guns at you. And they'll flash the light. I said, if you can tell red, green, and blue, and white, you're a pilot. So I did. And I got my private license.
Were you nervous about that? More nervous than going on a bombing run?
No. No. In fact, my first day of solo, I was caught by surprise because there's a little plane, a little Cessna 150, and with an instructor on board, you know, your takeoff time was a little longer. But when he jumped out of the plane and said, okay, you take it up, and I took it up, I was off the ground before I knew it because the plane was lighter. It literally just jumped off of the ground.
And much lighter than a B-17.
Yes, yes.
Well, Wayne, we're just about out of time. Thank you so much, as I said, first of all, for serving our country. And I know it's not about the decorations like the Distinguished Flying Cross. I'm sure that you, like so many veterans, would tell us you were just doing your job, but we appreciate that. We do not take it for granted. We don't take our freedom for granted. Is there anything else that you'd like to share about the men that you served with, the people that served our country during World War II, why you did it, and why it needs to be remembered today?
I think, Paul, that there was a binding of people together and a spirit that I have never seen since, really. And, you know, I lost a lot of buddies from Bombardier School. You know, I lost them before I even got over. And, in fact, my B-24 crew, they were shot down. I found that out afterwards. So
That gets your attention, too.
That got my attention, too.
Somebody had a plan for you.
Yes, I think so.
Well, I'm very thankful for that, and thankful it worked out exactly the way it did. Thankful that you were willing to come and share with us today. Wayne Thompson has been our guest today. Again, if you want to see some pictures of Wayne, what he looked like during World War II, some of the things he experienced, go to kmjnow.com, look for Hometown Heroes, or go to the new Facebook page. Just search for Hometown Heroes on Facebook. That's our program for today. Thanks so much for listening on News Talk 580 KMJ.